Well, welcome to this morning, to this lecture, to this introduction, to this helicopter flight over existential analysis, and we will see this the city below and the main buildings, and in some of the buildings we are landing and stepping in a little bit to see how it looks like. And tomorrow we are not making a helicopter flight. Tomorrow we are just walking through the city and try to practice as much as possible. I would like to present myself a little bit. I came from Vienna last night with quite a delay, but all flights were cancelled. Mine was the first one which came through to London, so I was happy. I was lucky that it worked out. I'm Austrian. I'm living in Vienna. I have a family with four adult children. My wife is also psychotherapist and in existential training. She retired now halfway. But I'm not going to retire, because what I do is so lovely that I like to continue. It's really fulfilling me and gives me opportunity to continue to grow and to develop something that I always liked during my life. I studied medicine and psychology and a bit philosophy. I have my private practice in Vienna. I studied in the field of psychiatry, social psychiatry. Please come in. For years, I have a private practice as a physician and as a clinical psychologist and as a coach. I'm also doing coaching seminars in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and applying this anthropology for coaching, which is very, very effective in coaching. And I'm teaching at various universities, mainly in Russia. I'm there for a whole month every year, and in Austria at the Sigmund Freud University in Klagenfurt. And I'm an invited speaker in many universities around the world. I'm traveling a lot. I was the president of the International Society at DLE, this is Gesellschaft für Logotherapie und Existenzanalyse, which is editing also this journal and making congresses. And as such, I was, and I'm still traveling around the world. We have societies in North America, Central America, South America, in many countries in Europe, and I'm continuously traveling around in these societies, giving lectures and assisting in seminars and so on. And now we are jumping over to England. Contrary to the Brexit movement, we try to connect England with more with Europe. So I hope this is also fashionable. I heard that about 60% of English people would like to remain connected, so we will see what is coming out. But on the psychological level, we are eager to be with you and also to be in England. So, and this is my first public activity in England. I was here last summer on a conference at the Roehampton University, but now, thanks to our beautiful ladies who are so active psychologists, we have this possibility, and hopefully we can build up something in England. I worked with Viktor Frankl for about 10 years. Do you know Viktor Frankl? Many people know it. He's quite famous. He lived in Vienna from 1905 to 1997. He became quite old, and I had the privilege to work with him for about 10 years, and we were in daily contact and discussed a lot of theory, but also organization issues and practical themes. And so I'm very deeply in the field of logotherapy, which is the name as what Frankl gave to his movement, and was traveling with him also to various conferences and lectures and so on. And then there was a split because the younger generation did much more development, and Frankl agreed with this development, and so this is very high quality development, but it's no more the pure logotherapy, and therefore he preferred to have a pure logotherapy according to his writings and teachings and the development which we call existential analysis. No. Existential analysis is a term which Frankl used for his anthropology in the late 20s, early 30s of the last century. He said existential analysis means an analysis of the conditions of a good existence, and their practice is coming to a life full of meaning. Meaning in Greek is logos, and therefore he called the practical application logotherapy. So we have the two terms, but Frankl used only logotherapy and had in the background the term existential analysis as a description of the theory behind. And then I had a long discussion with him that we should rename that and enlarge that logotherapy and call it existential analysis. And we had for over a year a discussion. He didn't want, he said, there is Daseinsanalysis in Switzerland and Germany, and Daseinsanalysis is translated as existential analysis. And so there will be a confusion. There are several existential analyses. And nobody calls their existential approach logotherapy, but I do, and so I remain on logotherapy. But I got his okay to call our training right from the beginning. We started in 1982 with our training in existential analysis and logotherapy, to name it existential analysis and logotherapy, after a year of hard discussions and even fights. There was quite a tension in this, and now I understand why it was such a tension, because it was the signal of a development. He understood clearly, when we start to speak about existential analysis, this is a broader axis which is not simply based on meaning, but has more existential aspects in the development. And so he said, okay, do what you want and what you can be responsible for. I will not be against. This was the okay for this. So I'm saying this because existential analysis is also a term for a psychotherapy movement in England. And there is a university, Regent University, and another university where existential analysis is taught, but it is a different existential analysis. We have in common existential philosophy, and then on the basis of SAS and anti-psychiatrists, and on the basis of the philosophy of Sartre, in the 80s of the last century, there was a movement which called themselves existential analysis. And I think it was 1983 or so, or I don't know the exact year, but it is a coincidence. At the same time, we in Vienna started to call our training also existential analysis, and we didn't know from each other. Mm. So there is now more confusion with that term, but existential analysis from England and existential analysis from Vienna have a common basis rooted in existential philosophy and phenomenology. But we, as you can see, there are, as even siblings are different sometimes from each other, so that you don't even recognize that they are siblings. So we are siblings somehow, but are quite different at the same time. Based on the primary assumption of what it means to come to a real life, not just to resolve problems or to reduce the psychodynamic in one's life, this is not our primary focus, or to make a different learning at a better adaptation to the world, which is the in CBT the primary background. No, this is not our focus. Our focus is, what does it mean to really live? To really live. We will always have problems. There will always be pain in our life. We cannot resolve all conflicts. But we can become more ourselves within this world and try to reduce the problems, the conflicts which in which we are in family. We have pain and trauma and suffering from in our biography, and we can work on them and reduce their pain and come to a peace and forgiveness, etc. This is of course a task, but in the center of this task is our being myself, being authentic, being truly myself, being in a good dialogue with myself, being connected with myself, being in touch and feeling myself, being, as we say, becoming more personalized, becoming more person, becoming more personal in our life. And so the existential movement in psychology has this aim, this focus. And of course we need learning processes like in CBT or the work with drives and psychodynamics and psychic tensions as in depth psychology. This is also needed, but the focus, the accent is different. The entrance is different. So our sibling in England has the same aim. They do not make diagnosis and do not reduce the human being to a psychopathology. We say, when we have an open access, this is a little different, when we have an open access to human beings and to ourselves, it is also good to make a diagnosis and call this is a phobia, or this is addiction, or this is depression, and even to apply a medication when a depression is too deep that the physical aspect of the depression is also treated, and not to refuse that or to withdraw from that, but to work with this. So we are more medical, maybe more working in the psychopathology, and we have really different treatments of different diagnoses. We treat an anxiety differently than a depression. In the humanistic psychology is the broad approach into which belong not only the existential movement, but also the Rogerian movement, the Gestalt movement, psychodrama. In all humanistic psychology, making diagnosis is something not very much loved. There are movements who don't do it, but there are movements who do it. Movements which do it, and we belong to that section in the humanistic psychology which says we also need to have to see what is going on a physical level, on a psychodynamic level, And what is a fixation in psychodynamics which makes it a disorder, and we call it a disorder? Like in our biological life, we can have a flu, and it is a flu, and not HIV. And it is important to make that difference, to know that difference. And because the treatment will be different. And so it is in the psychic level. So, existential analysis in England, very humanistic, very philosophical, more philosophical than we are, very much based on Heidegger also, and existential analysis from Vienna has a philosophical background, but also a psychiatric background, and we can see that stream. Frankl was a psychiatrist, and he used his psychiatric knowledge in the application of logotherapy. For Frankl, the main theme was help people to find meaning. Once he was asked, Viktor Frankl, you worked a whole life for helping people, for about meaning. What is the meaning of your life? And he said, the meaning of my life is to help people to find meaning. So this was really true. He was really engaged in this work. And this work has a history. So let me start a little bit with the history and then to come to the actual development. Please come in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. That people can still come. Yeah, this history gives us also a better understanding why at all we have an existential movement in psychology. Viktor Frankl, as a youngster, was in contact with Sigmund Freud, and he was writing him letters, and Freud answered him the letters, and Freud even published a paper of him, which he sent him, and Frankl was fascinated by this new movement of psychology which came up at that time in the 20s of the last century, and then at the beginning of his medical studies, he wrote Freud that he would like to undergo a training in psychoanalysis, and Freud forwarded him to Paul Feden, who was at that time the secretary of the psychoanalytic movement in Vienna. And Frankl had a talk with him, but after this talk, he became aware that psychoanalysis is not what he could do, because Feden did not say anything personal to him. Feden saw him only in his pathology. The first question, Feden didn't even say hello, good morning, didn't give a greeting, because he was so perfectly abstinent, a psychoanalyst, at least at that time, or strong psychoanalysts are. I have also been in a psychoanalysis for a certain time, and my analyst never shake my hands. This is too much closeness. So strict psychoanalysts are very restricted, separated, to provoke transference, which is the tool how they work. And so Frankl, after silently having shown to sit down, got the first question from Paul Feden. Now, Mr. Frankl, what is your disorder? And so he felt so much reduced to psychopathology and not having had any human contact. And he said, this cannot be the way how I could work for a whole life. And so he decided not to go there to the training, but switched over to Alfred Adler, who also was in Vienna, and did the training there, and he completed the training as an Adlerian. And but then, in the Adlerian movement, he dared to speak about meaning and made a public presentation in a conference where he said that not only the psychodynamic arrangements and the minority complex is important and moving us, but people strive to get to find a meaning in their life. And then Adler threw him out of the society. This is not allowed to speak about in our society. And then he was alone. And then he started to read much more the philosophy of Max Scheler, and Max Scheler had an elaborated philosophical anthropology based on values and feelings, and so on this basis he developed something what he was searching for since his childhood, meaning. Since a child, he was always interested in what is meaning. Somehow he was born with. And together with Scheler's philosophy, he could really develop a theory and develop logotherapy. As a counter-reaction to that psychology of his time. And the idea behind is that we must help the human being to become more human, more himself or herself, on the basis of what makes us really human. Because the theme of depth psychology is a theme which we can also, where things happen to us. But we are in the relationship with our parents. Freud said that the young boy wants to be in love, in physical love with his mother. The young girl, later on, he didn't speak about girls, but his daughters, about to be in physical love with the father. And so, and there are some tendencies, there's sexuality around in our values of life and what attracts us. There is this aspect. Of course, it is there, but this is not what makes us really human. What makes us really human is how we deal with it, what we do with it. Of course, there are strong tendencies which are dominating us, at least sometimes. But what really counts is what we do in a way that we can be responsible, that we can feel that this is my life, this is what I did. So giving answer is the main theme in existence. Dealing with it, not just becoming a victim, this may happen, but then the question is, and now, what are you going on to do with it? What is the question of your life? What do you understand? What should you do with that? What can you do with it? What do you like to do with it? What is appropriate to you? What fits to you? And what is something which brings about a new value? These are the existential questions. That makes us really human. When I have a problem with my partner, okay, this is not what I would like to have. It's there. So, we can remain on the level of shouting to each other and fighting and protecting and trying to dominate the partner or so, and to have right in any case, then we are moving on a psychodynamic level. This is the level where depth psychology is working perfectly and where behavioral therapy is working perfectly or systemic therapy is working perfectly. We also need to work on this, and we do, but we say, be aware, and now comes the specific existential element. Be aware that you have this conflict. This conflict means something to you. This conflict is challenging you to become more yourself, to be more yourself. It's challenging you to find out what is your task to work on, to look at. Do you understand why it is so? Do you understand yourself? Why you feel that way? Why it is so difficult for you? You can be a sovereign in this conflict. You should try, or can try, to be superior, to lift up, to stand up on your own legs, and to give authentic answers, to intervene authentically as the one who you are, in constant connection with yourself, that you feel fine with yourself when you intervene in this way, or when you ask that, or when you do this. This makes you really human, and this lifts you up from the dynamics of conflicts and problems and traumas, etc. They are there, of course, and we have to deal with them, to live with them, but we can also deal with them, we can shape them. This is our task, to shape our reality. Then we become ourselves. And this is focusing the really human in the human. This was the beginning of this humanistic psychology, humanistic movement within psychology, where Viktor Frankl was really one of the first who started it, in direct contact with Freud and Adler and his experiences, that he finally rejected the purely psychoanalytic movement. He was thrown out from the Adlerian individual psychology movement because they were purely psychodynamic, and Frankl was, by his personality, too much interested in being human, what really counts in one's life. And then this was very helpful for him when he, as the history brought it about, when he had to go into the concentration camp during World War II. As a Jewish person, he was put into 4 concentration camps and passed 2.5 years of his life in concentration camps. How to survive under such difficult life situation. He wrote about this in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, which is really a deep psychological book, still a bestseller in the United States. And what really counts, and he said, people who lost their meaning in concentration camp, they simply died away. They got infected, they had infections, and they were so weakened that they died under these circumstances. But having a meaning helps to survive. Meaning is not only an important psychological value, it is, as he called it, a survival value. And so he experienced that, and thanks to his conviction, which he lived before he developed logotherapy, before the concentration camp, he had a clear understanding and helped many people. He gave constant lectures in his sleeping dormitories, in the dormitories, on finding meaning, etc., which was also helpful for himself to be able to do something positive for other people, which has a feedback on oneself, that one feels better when I can see that I do something positive to other people. So now you get a first understanding, to sum it up, of why there was an existential movement developed on the background as a trial to focus on that what is really human. Frankl developed logotherapy in the existential analysis based on his own personality. Of course, this is a basis that he was striving for, that he was burning for meaning. And then he found his theoretical partner in the philosophy of Max Scheler. I mean, you could write down that name. But the focus is to raise above the conditions. Psychotherapy, most psychotherapies deal with adapting to conditions or seeking, looking deeper on the reasons behind of these conditions, why these conditions are so, why the experiences are so, as in depth psychology. And these are is very valuable. But the entrance to the human being and to psychotherapy and counseling in the existential approach is look at what, how can you deal with this? What can I do? How can I apply my freedom? Because ultimately we are free human beings. There is a certain degree of freedom. We are not totally free, but we are partially free. Use this partial freedom in your life. And when you make use of it, then you are existing. So deal with it. Give your personal answer. And so coin your life situation, shape it, form it. Make it something special. Make your conflict a personal one. Bring yourself in personally. Say what you personally feel about it. Enter into dialogue. Dialogue is so important. It's an essential issue in all humanistic psychologies and also for us. This means, philosophically speaking, our existence is not something. It's not there. It's not fixed. It's something we are shaping every moment. We give the shape to our existence, willingly or not willingly, consciously or not consciously. We are connected with our existence. We are responsible for our existence. Even when we are victims, we are never only victims. We are always contributing something to our lives. We are always making something of it. We are more entangled in our life, in our biography, than we may think of. To make that aware, that we are the one who are finally, ultimately responsible for our existence. Many things may happen to us. We may have a cancer. We may have an accident. This is how life goes. But to bring ourselves into it, this is what means to be, to really live our life, to make ourselves present, to be there. The philosophical term for to be there is to exist. So let us, on this background, where we learned what is the focus of existential movement, what is the specific of the existential movement, this activation of one's own freedom and helping people to come to their own responsibility in each situation. On this background, let us have in the next step a look on what is existence, and then from there to develop the specific of existential analysis. Existence is a term which we use in everyday life nowadays. It's not only restricted to philosophy. It has a specific meaning in philosophy, but this meaning is very similar to the meaning which is given to the term when we use it in everyday life. Do I exist? What is your answer? Do you exist? What is your opinion? What is your feeling? You would say, hey, of course. This is not a question on a university level. Of course I exist. But what does it mean, I exist? Are there human beings existing on the Mars? As far as we know, no. No life exists on the Mars. This means there is no life. There is no being of life. Existence and being are connected. I am. I exist. I think. Therefore, I must exist. Otherwise, I couldn't think, as Descartes wrote. I exist, I am there. But if we have a closer look, do I really exist? Am I really here? Am I really present in my family, in my relationship, in my working place? And we all detect immediately that there are different levels and degrees of existing, of being there. Sometimes I'm more there, sometimes I'm less there. Sometimes I'm just physically there, but not mentally, spiritually, not with my heart. So, I'm present in my relationship. But if I'm not present there with my heart, it's a very reduced form of presence, isn't it? What belongs to existence? And what does it really mean? This is a great theme. This is the basic question for existential philosophy. Starting with Nietzsche, Kierkegaard, going over to Heidegger, Scheler, Jaspers, Merleau-Ponty, Sartre, Camus, etc., many philosophers. Psychology detected that what they described in their thinking and the reflections on what existence means is very helpful also for psychology. So just when you say existential analysis, why is it called existential analysis? It has to do with existence. And existence has to do with being. My being here, my being there. And deepening it, this means what are the prerequisites needed that I can be really there, fully there, or here. And existence is limited, limited in time. We have maybe 80 years or so to live. And then we have to die. And it is difficult to die before I have been really here. To go before I have been here is very hard. When I have been really here, I can feel satisfied, full of life. I can become tired of life, as I am tired every evening, and go to sleep. Sleep is the little brother of death. And so, this, yeah, existentially seen, we are training to die every day when we go to sleep. We give it up. We let it be. And we have to train our life, because our life is limited in power, in force, in conditions, in energy, in money, in time. And all existential philosophers include death as something belonging to life. We are mortal since the beginning. We don't become mortal when we are 80. We are mortal when we are born, and even before. So, human existence is a mortal existence, and somehow we have to think about or to deal with this reality of mortality. And what does it mean for our life? Because when we are going to die one day, and we are absolutely not prepared, we can become very nervous, very tense. But I have seen many people dying, and I worked in the hospital. They die very differently. Some people die very quietly, peacefully, even smilingly. And some people suffer. It's a torture for them. And especially when you have a bad moral conscience, when it comes to die, it's something metaphysical comes up in our feelings. And then it is hard. So, when we have a good life, then we can have a good death. And we all, Sigmund Freud already said, we owe life a death. We are in that. This is a provisional situation. So, we should make use of it and be really there. And then we really live. And we get good feelings for our life and do our best and construct our life and help others and ourselves, and then we can also die peacefully, because we have fulfilled our existence. So what are the prerequisites of existence? What do we need to come to a full existence? And what does it mean to exist? I'll come back to the prerequisites. This will be the central theme after this. And to give a better understanding of existence, does it mean to exist? Before, we said that existential psychology means dealing with the situation, not just being exposed, but to do my best, to do what I can do, and to, on this level, to give my being more presence, to bring myself into existence. And I said, we are forming, shaping our life, our being there. We are shaping our relationship, we are shaping our working situation. And this means existence has something, it has the focus on how am I raising above the situation. This is a figure which happened already in the evolution. Once we were moving on our four legs and then hanging on the trees with our four legs and two arms and two legs. And now the human being moved up from this animal position, standing up onto two legs. Two legs we have in common with the animals. With every dog or cow or horse or ape, on two legs we are standing within nature and rooted in nature. And we are, animals do not make decisions. We are not deciding. This is what is happening to us, our biological life, our drives, etc. All this comes up by itself. But two legs, our four legs, are now no more legs. They converted into arms, which is symbolic of this gives me freedom to do something, to act. Not just to react, but to decide to take something into my hands, to shape it, to form it, to develop it. Always standing in the nature of my animalistic part of being. We have developed a big forebrain which allows us to think, to develop a will, to decide. And in parallel to this, we have the freedom of arms and the horizon of a view, of a worldview. We detect ourselves being in a world, the world of my family, the world of my history, the world of my working situation, being together with other people. There is me, otherness. And of this I become really aware when I lift up from my four legs and standing now on my two legs and have become a human being. A human being, being in the world, is being in the world is fundamental in the philosophy of Martin Heidegger. We are beings who cannot understand themselves without seeing myself intertwined to the world, that I am in a constant contact with otherness. This makes me me, because there are others. Psychological, the developmental psychology shows us that the human being cannot become human, cannot find himself or herself without the encounter with other people, without a culture. We need this being interwoven and connected and encountering other people to become myself. Without a thou, a you, I will never know who is me. Only in the eyes of the other and in the dialogue, in the exchange with the other, I can get an idea of who is me. Together we develop me. This is existence. This means raising myself above the ground with all the conditions and the needs and the programs and the fixations. I'm of course fixed on this ground. I can jump, but not more by myself. I cannot fly. I must move on this ground, which fixes me, which takes me away to freedom. Freedom, if we understand freedom, if I want to fly, I should be able to fly. No, this is not freedom. Freedom is dealing with what is there. Freedom is connected with reality. So, I have to deal with my being connected to the earth and not being able to fly away. But I can make use of it. So I can walk. This means human freedom. Not flying, but walking. Making use of what is there. And there is always something valuable, what is there, what I can use. Existence, to make it short, is this raising above the conditions and implying my freedom, my little space of freedom, which I have in every situation. There is no situation. Because eventually I can always kill myself. Existential philosophy, radically. We don't have to live. No human being has to live. This is a great difference to animals. No animal can suicide, can make, commit suicide. Only human beings. So this means radical freedom. We are not forced to live. We can live. And when we can live, it is my decision to continue. But how, what makes me decide to continue? Sometimes you may even think it would be better that if you could die, if you were dead. Such situations can happen in one's life. So, freedom, imply freedom, because we are radically free, we should make use of this human capacity. This is the axis of existential psychology. Make use of your freedom, because you are free and you cannot stop to be free. Because we are essentially free. Our essence is freedom. Existence, the degree of freedom in the midst of our conditions and limitations. Five seconds, change the video. Okay. Is there any question so far?
In the freedom to be with something as opposed to going away from it. You always have the freedom to go away.
Yeah.
As well.
I'm coming to that as next. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, you have to.
I want to ask about, there's a lot of focus on the concept of freedom, and without it, I think we can't step out of this discussion. I've always had a problem, and I'd like to see what you think about this, but what do you think about how it applies to individuals, or how you can apply into existential analysis if possible at all? Individuals who are limited in terms of either physical freedom, and we're talking about people who literally have no choice even to kill themselves, could be in a room locked up forever, you know, by a captor. Somebody who has mental limited mental freedom, so basically cannot even make those decisions cognitively. Does that make them less human?
Yeah.
Existentialist.
Yeah. This is a question on the borders of existence, when people are extremely handicapped or not even conscious of themselves or so. Is there freedom? There is no freedom of action, of course. Indeed, these are very few people, but this is a theoretical, a principal question about freedom. But there is still the freedom of essence. We worked with such people, and they are dialoguing with us, even when they can't speak, even if they are almost never really conscious about themselves. They are dialoguing with us about their smelling. They make have different smells. When they feel happy, they have a good smell in the body. When they are not happy, this is how they can express themselves. There is something in them what makes them still human, even these extreme cases. In these extreme cases, it's incredible. They are moving differently, and one can feel from outside how it is within this enclosed being that there is some still a person. And we have some few experiences with people who were in coma for a long time, that about 60% of coma people they have brain activities which has some similarities with the awakened brain activities, so that we can assume that they are somehow working on their impressions, on what is going on within them and without them. And some of them even can remember later a little bit that they have been aware of something. So these are, of course, very challenging situations in understanding of the human being. In our daily practice, we do not have to deal with such patients. In special clinics, a few psychologists work with them. But let us apply this question, what human freedom really means. And this brings us to the next step, to the description of existential analysis. What is the focus of existential analysis? Or what is the specific? How can we define it? It is an existential psychology. So all what we said before is valuable and true for existential analysis. But we are going to specify this by saying that if we are really beings who can make decisions, conscious decisions, and we also make unconscious decisions without thinking a lot on an emotional basis, on an embodied embodiment of myself. But we do something and we can feel free. This is the criteria. As long as I feel free, we say this is that amount of freedom which I am able to realize. It may turn out later on that it was not so free as I thought. Okay, there is no warranty, but as long as we feel free, we are essentially ourselves. When I don't have to do something, when I can do what I want, what I decide, well, then I am free and I feel so. And the most basic form of decision is this, to feel an inner yes to what I do. To feel an inner yes. most basic form of application of freedom. You may feel an inner yes for sitting here. Yes, it's okay. I agree. It's my will, it's my intention. An inner yes to do it, to what I do. I'm sitting here and I feel free because I feel I'm not forced to sit here. Nobody forced me. It was me who decided, who wanted to come, because I felt attracted by the theme. It is interesting for myself, for my work, for my thoughts, for my studies, for my life philosophy, for whatever, but it is interesting somehow. And so I said, it would be good to go there. I like to go there. I can go there. Yeah. And so I feel free by sitting here. And if I don't like it, we will soon have a break. It is very nice to me. Yes?
Can I just ask you to clarify when you refer to people with limited abilities, such when you...
Now I'm referring to every human being.
Yes,
yeah.
Going back to that, when you use the term on the margins.
On the margins, yeah.
On the margins of society, not being human.
It's also valuable for them, it's also applicable to them. In the dialogue we need specific forms of expressing or dealing or dialoguing with these people on the margin of being. But in principle it's also, do you have an inner yes to this food, to being fed by me, and they react differently. People we care for, they do not want to be fed by everybody, they prefer to be fed by somebody. And so you have the same, in a very small area, but the same principle of, do I feel an inner yes to what I do, to how I behave, can I accept it, etc. This is, practically speaking, the center of our existence from the point of view of existential analysis. Can I feel my yes to what I do? And if I feel a yes to what I do, then I say, I'm concordant with that. I agree. I feel an inner consent. So we can define existential analysis in the shortest way to help people or to do it by ourselves, to live with inner consent to what I do. Inner consent is a felt yes And practically speaking, this is applicable to all situations. Here, now. Do I have a yes to the coffee in the break, or to go for a walk, or to look around, what are the possibilities which I have? Possibilities open ways to freedom. Because what is possible does not mean that I'm forced to. I can say yes or no, then it is a possibility. And to try to live as much as possible in such a way that I only do things where I have an inner consent for. And this means it is a felt yes. This is not just rational. But I say, it's logical, it's rational, it's practical, it's functional, it is... It gives more money, it makes, gives more more success, more career. If it is not felt, it is existentially seen rubbish. It is career, but existential rubbish. And then people fall into an existential vacuum. They become depressive, they become anxious, because they alienate themselves, they lose themselves, they go away from themselves. And then you have the whole bunch of psychopathology coming up. They burn out when they do too much, more than they have consent for. Because when I have a consent, I may be tired and I still do something more, because like actually we have burnout coming up in the European physicians because of the flu epidemic. There are millions of people suffering from flu, and the doctors are working day and night. But when I feel I'm at the end, I don't have a consent anymore, then I must stop. I cannot, or maybe I say, this is a 2-year-old child, here I can't stop, I go there. But then I feel it from my heart that I cannot give help in that case. I cannot bear it. Then it is also coming from the heart. And then we are not burning out, or we are burning out a little bit, but recovering quickly, because it was just an over-demand of the situation. Only when we live with inner consent, we are in congruence with ourselves. Then we live ourselves. Then we bring ourselves into this world, into this situation. Because inner consent is something I cannot order to myself. Inner consent comes out by itself. I cannot make it. Here you see a so-called phenomenological attitude towards ourselves. This means, in other words, and radical openness to apply freedom even towards myself, to let myself free. I cannot order myself what is congruent to myself. I have to perceive it, to see it. And then let it act upon me. And then see what it makes with me, what the inner resonance towards it is, what comes up in me. I'm so free that I, with my rationality, with my consciousness, cannot order myself what I feel, what is congruent, concordant with myself. But I can detect myself alongside of this inner resonance, who I am, what fits to me. This is a constant detection of myself, a constant growing and becoming more myself. This makes life so wonderful and interesting to find out every day, in every situation, what I feel a yes for, what is resonating well within me. To receive myself, to receive the one who I am, and make me more real, more present, bring me into existence, raise myself up, lift myself up into existence, into a full presence, allowing myself to be who I am. This is a miracle, the miracle of existence, which happens, can happen every minute. And then when we are aware of this, we live in a totally different world. We live in a richness. We live in the richness of an ongoing, miraculous process, becoming more myself and being able to share my true self with others by engaging. When I do something with inner consent, how do I feel? Then I'm really there. I feel strong. I feel awake. I feel active. I feel related. I have stronger feelings. I use tension, inner tension. It may produce tension with others. When I cannot agree with something, and I'm congruent with myself, I say, I'm sorry, I'm not, I cannot do that, I will not decide for that, or I see it differently, or I prefer this. It does not mean that this is just a peaceful life. But it makes me real. And this is worth fighting for that, or trying to bring it in and to give space to this essence of mine. And so when I do something with inner consent, I'm behind it, and I'm with this innerness, I'm like taking myself, putting myself into this situation, into this dialogue, into this counseling, into this cooking, into this cleaning the apartment, whatever it is, little things in the everyday life, into this talk with my boss or my colleague. I'm taking myself and bringing myself into it. For this, we have a Latin word which is used in English quite commonly. I am sending myself. I'm giving myself into this situation. I'm sending myself together with my action. In Latin, it is con mittere. This is come with mittery sending. This means commitment. I am personally engaged. Then I am committed. And what happens? Thank you. So the direct effect of such an awareness, attitude, or training to look at what is coming up in me, do I feel a yes or no? I sometimes have to work on it. And sometimes it's even difficult to find it out. But put the case, we found it. Then the consequence is, what I do with myself. This means commitment. Engage. And what is the effect, the subsequent effect of doing something with commitment? When I'm engaged, I am personally present. I am personally there. I feel what I do. I feel the value of what I do. I breathe the value. I take it up. I absorb it. And this gives me constantly something back. I feel how good it is that I'm here. It is valuable to be here. It's valuable to do this, to give this, to take this. And so I am in a constant dialogue with the situation, with the values of the situation, absorbing the values, taking them up, and having them, absorbing them, eating them, I become full, more and more full, absorbing the value of the situation, because I feel it, I am in connection. And this gives me inner fulfillment. So, if we reverse it, how do I get inner fulfillment in my life? When I can do something with commitment, when I'm personally present, you can put that below. Then I'm committed. And the basis is that I feel an inner yes. So when people suffer from a lack of fulfillment in their life, when they suffer from emptiness, from existential vacuum, as Frankl called it, from frustration, from not tasting life anymore, they are not looking enough to their inner consent. They are not living according their inner consent. They are either neglecting this, or are not able to refer to it because of pathology. There can be blockages. But, so, you see that connection. Everybody wants to have a full life, a fulfilling life. This is the criterion. Fulfillment is the criterion for existential attitude. This is how we, in existential analysis in Vienna, we specified these existential thoughts and how we work with. We will see after the break, we will see more how we work with this a bit more in depth. When I do things, let us have a look, a short look on the situation, when I do something without inner consent, when I just do it because everybody does it, or because it's fashionable, I don't know really if I have an inner consent, if I feel a yes or not, I'm doing it in an indifferent way, or I may even feel a no, I'm against, when I'm in a dissent. What happens then? I'm not committed. When I have to do something what I don't want to, what I do not agree with, this may be in my job, this may be in my studies, this may be in my everyday life, to cook or to clean the apartment, and I have to do it and nobody is sharing or dealing or respecting this or so, then I'm against. I feel used. I feel bad. Badly. And so when I have to do something, or even worse, in a very close relationship, in sexuality also, this is very close to one's personal intimacy and so, to when I have no consent, it's not me, I'm not there. It's a superficial, but sometimes sometimes hurtful, painful, suffering situation. And I'm not committed, but I'm lending myself. I lend myself. Let's make use of me. See, they are taking me away from me. And the result is inner void. I feel empty. I feel empty because they take me away. The situation takes me away. I cannot be myself in this situation. And then I'm not really there and I feel reduced, functionalized, emptied, very frustrated. We encounter these feelings often in counseling and psychotherapy. In all circumstances, in private and professional circumstances, and we suffer from it when this happens. And this has to do with the main existential focus. To live with inner consent means to realize my freedom. I'm connecting with the freedom of my essence, of my being, letting it free, what comes up. Accepting, taking up my depth, my ground, my essence. And it is, philosophically speaking, very complex. But it is not so difficult. Children know do it very well until they are educated. This is a spontaneous way of being. Therefore, it's good to have children to relearn how to live from them. When they have no inner consent, no agreement, it is hard to deal with them. But we should respect it and talk with them and ask them why and what and so on. Because they need our encounter, and they should learn, of course, and amplify, widen their horizon. So this is the main focus of existential analysis, and we can even define existential analysis as a method, a therapy, a counseling to help people to live with inner consent. When it works, it is good to make them aware, and I hope you can take from this morning at least this. If you just take this from this morning, I'm more than happy. Forget the rest, but to be attentive, to be mindful to this inner consent. We have it, we receive ourselves, we can take it up, we can realize it, and thus bring ourselves every day in every situation to a birth. We are rebirthing ourselves in every situation. And after the break, we have a closer look to how does it work when the inner consent is not just there, when there are difficulties, when I don't find it, this is of course the situation of counseling and psychotherapy. So, look at your inner consent. A, for the break. B, what you are going to do in the break. C, if you have a consent to come back. And if not, I say goodbye. So we make a 10 minutes break until 11:30.